You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Save big money on your next project now at Menards. Update your home with low-maintenance vinyl windows from JELD-WEN. They're durable, energy efficient, and are low maintenance. Menards carries over 100 different size and style options in stock, ready to take home today. Save big on JELD-WEN windows now at Menards. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Monster House presents.
Monster Talk is proud to be a part of the Airwave Media family, home of such shows as Fork in the Road, Small Things Often, and Therapist Uncensored. If you'd like to advertise on this show, contact sales at advertisecast.com. At Monster Talk, we're always looking into mysteries, but there's one mystery which only you can provide the answer for. Who are you? Airwave Media is doing a network-wide audience survey, and we would love to learn more about you, our listeners, the people who make this show possible with your support and attention. Just go to surveymonkey.com/r/airwave, all one word. So that's surveymonkey.com/r, like the letter R, /airwave. But don't worry, I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Select Monster Talk from the drop-down list of shows and then fill out the simple questions to tell us more about who you are. We hope to hear from you. That's surveymonkey.com/r/airwave. Thanks.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk. Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stoltzner.
Belief is such a fascinating aspect of being human. We throw the word belief around with confidence that such a well and frequently used word will be understood by everyone. But the truth is that people often mean wildly different things when they say that word. In psychology, there's a concept called theory of mind that encapsulates how we as individuals extrapolate other people's inner mindsets through watching their behavior and listening to their words. But we can never really know what's going on inside other people's heads. Do you remember that gold dress, blue dress viral moment from a few years back when everyone was freaking out that some people could look at a photo and see a blue dress while others saw it as gold? There was a really important lesson there about the concept of qualia. That's the inner experience of thought, which we can never know. When someone says they see something that's yellow, what does that really mean? That's qualia. Belief, being part of the mind, is necessarily also mired in the complexity of our messy biology and our complex social structures. Science is perhaps our best set of tools for trying to establish an unambiguous framework for comparing and studying phenomena. But that framework requires a lot of training and expertise in order for it to be wielded in an unbiased way. And the truth is that the majority of us are not in possession of such training, and we get by the best we can manage using our own experiences to craft heuristics that allow us to navigate the complex world competently without ever knowing for sure if the stuff we believe is, in fact, true. Sometimes, We get very focused on that question of what's true. But here at Monster Talk, we also like to keep in mind that we're all just people trying to make it through this confusing and sometimes mysterious world. Beliefs are the secret rules guiding our own behavior and the unwritten guidebook that we use to interpret the behavior of others. When personal or community beliefs are wildly out of synchronization with the mainstream, the conditions are ripe for conflict, drama, and sometimes even transcendent or joyful interactions. Those are the ingredients for the book, The Believer, Encounters with the Beginning, the End, and Our Place in the Middle, by Sarah Krasnstein. She takes the reader on a fascinating tour through six different stories across two continents, covering a wide variety of ideas that include life, death, forgiveness, grief, fear, and of course, hope. You're listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. Let's go talk with Sarah Krasnstein right now and hear about her book and how it came to be.
Monster Talk.
We welcome to the show Dr. Sarah Krasnstein, and she is a multi-award-winning writer and critic. She's the best-selling author of The Trauma Cleaner, The Believer, and the quarterly essay Not Waving Drowning, and a number of other books too. Very prolific author, and she holds a PhD in criminal law. So welcome to the show, Sarah.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah.
And I'm so excited to have you on. We've got a mutual friend, Toby Ball, who we've had on Monster Talk before. And you seem to be the inverse of me. I'm an Australian living in America, and you're an American living in Australia.
We've swapped. That's good. Yeah.
We have, yeah. Doing our time.
Yeah. It's good. We probably have exactly the same problems, but just flipped.
Absolutely, I'm sure. But we wanted to bring you on the show in particular to talk about your book, The Believer. It's a really fascinating book. And there's just so much to unpack here. You've received a lot of praise for the book as a very empathetic book. You're very compassionate towards believers of a number of different belief systems and just interesting topics. So, I'm hoping we can just delve into some of these and that all of our listeners will go and buy your book.
Thank you. Hopefully.
Yeah, it's well worth a read. I'm going to go in throughout the topics are things that will be of interest to our listeners, and the style is gorgeous and poetic, and it reminds me very much of...
Yes.
A few books came to mind, some stuff by John Ronson, Colin Dickey, and then especially I was thinking about Will Storr. He wrote a book called Will Storr and the Supernatural, which it reminds me of. But I like how you hop around to these different viewpoints, different topics, and you're not judgy. Mm-hmm. It's really thoughtful and interesting and engaging. Well, and I like
Judgy.
We like sarcasm and snark. I was going to say you're covering topics that I think our listeners may have strong opinions on one way or the other, and I think you do this in a style that seems very fair to everybody. So I like that. That's nice. So,
thanks, guys. Thank you.
So I guess to begin with, I think if you could tell us a little bit about the book and what inspired you to write the book.
Yeah, sure. So to call it a process would probably be overly generous, but every time I embark on something that's going to be kind of a book-length work, it really does, it's not kind of an intellectual process of setting out on a kind of quest to discover something. It's more kind of following a feeling or an attraction to, a certain kind of area or story or person. And with The Believer, I literally stumbled across a full Mennonite choir singing down in a Bronx subway station on a very hot summer's day. And they were slightly bizarre and absurd because they were so optically and culturally different to everyone else around them and singing their hearts out, and no one was paying attention. And that's a very New York thing. But at the same time, there was something in me that really was kind of transfixed by this beautiful harmony. And they're not professional singers. They'd be the first to tell you that. And there was something kind of in that clash of what was going on and all of these different kind of lives intersecting that gave me pause. And anyway, that's that was the beginning of spending a few months kind of embedded, visiting with two of the families. They're Mennonite missionaries who come from a predominantly white town in Pennsylvania. And they had kind of insinuated themselves into a Black and Latino community in the Bronx, where they were proselytizing quite unsuccessfully for a number of years. And kind of in the end, it seems, speaking mainly to themselves. And I wanted to understand kind of why they did that, what it meant to them, what the world looked like through their eyes. And the more they spoke, the more it kind of touched on themes. There was a kind of a phrase that I had kind of got snagged on, which I had was hearing in these other stories that I was simultaneously kind of researching, which was, this can't be all there is. This current life, this current world, this reality, this planet isn't all there is. And so it was simultaneously this dissatisfaction with like daily life, the world as it is, and this optimism, this hope, this yearning for something different. And so in the kind of Valentich story and the ufology story that I was pursuing, that was something that I heard all the time from UFO researchers. It was something that I was hearing from this woman who had murdered her husband, who I met right after she was released after 35 years in prison. And she was quite religious as well, and she had said it. And so I was interested in the connections between what kind of presented on its face as very different stories about very different people.
I'm just say it's another area where you and I are similar. I had a similar experience to that, to your Mennonite experience, going back about maybe 10 years ago. And I encountered a group of Amish people who were singing in rural Colorado and had a similar experience to that. So, yeah, I mean, they're Amish and Mennonites are very closely related, going back to the Swiss Brethren. I'm sure you researched all of that. But, it's quite a spiritual experience, even if you don't share the same beliefs. It's really beautiful to hear them singing. It's an incredible experience.
I'm so glad that you raised that, because it really is kind of this, the beauty of kind of a unified belief system that binds these people into a community. It holds them through periods of uncertainty or injustice or fear. And it's something that, again, like if you buy into the entirety of any too perfect narrative or too perfect belief system, whatever it is, and, you know, whatever religion, whatever kind of, you know, area of interest, that kind of total buy-in has this beautiful, almost suspicious perfection that is so attractive that it really is, you know, transfixing.
Absolutely. I can see why it inspired an entire book.
We have our regular theme song, but under the cover, like every topic we cover is more like a Roxy Music, because there's always that more than this, you know, theme to all of this.
Beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
Huge fan. Oh, wow. Yeah. Beautiful.
Yeah. But it's true. I mean, it's like we've talked many times about the Bigelow Aerospace and the way they want to, you know, dig into UFOs and they're sort of presenting it like it's an inquiry into weird technology. But the secondary question that has literally always been there is there a survival of consciousness? And so they always present it like it's a technology UFO question, but that secondary spiritual question is always on the table, always. And I think that's the, maybe it's not spoken aloud, but it's always there. So,
yes, yeah, and I mean that was kind of there in each of these stories as well, Blake. That's something that I, you know, that kind of hope that you know things go on, and you know it's in all of us, and you know, and that beauty that no one can say conclusively that it doesn't. So, I don't think mockery or, you know, proving or disproving at the level of fact is really as interesting as exploring kind of the yearning that runs beneath all these things, which in the end unites vastly different people in vastly different belief systems.
You cover the Ark encounter part.
Yes.
And you do it using the geologist, I believe, who is... she's a young Earth creation. I've seen her interviewed many times. Georgia. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And I found that fascinating because Ken Ham is, you know, even in the book, you have to say it. He loves to say that molecules to man evolution, you know, like he can't just say evolution. He's got to say molecules to man evolution. And it's like, I know it grates on me, but there's something about the way you present it that kind of gave me a little bit of, empathy for the attendees, like, because I know a lot of people who are, you know, very pro science go there just to kind of laugh at it. But a lot of people because it's a reification of their beliefs. They really believe these things are literally true, and they're seeing it laid out and explained in ways they can understand, and they think it like confirms the Bible's story. So you did. That's a tightrope to walk, to not make fun of stuff. I think that it, from a scientific perspective, is ludicrous, but from a faith perspective, is literally, you know, right there in the text.
I mean, Bill Nye and others of that stripe have gone out there to defeat creationism with science, and that's not really my interest. I was, again, like, you know, this is 4 years of my life that I spent with these themes and thinking about these people and reading about their work and meeting them. And I wouldn't do that for the purposes of mockery. I'm kind of looking for something that's more enlarging of, you know, my intellect and consciousness, and something that kind of is more enduring than that. That's not to say that certain beliefs aren't very dangerous and they don't have immediate consequences. And I write in the book about kind of this hateful approach to gender and sexuality difference and all the rest of it, which is actually quite hateful and dangerous. But underneath what they are saying, which really does boil down to the fact that if death isn't a punishment for sin, as it is explained in the black letter of scriptural authority, then none of this living and dying makes sense. And there was something so kind of young and wounded in that kind of purposive reasoning that I think we can all relate to in our weaker or, you know, more desperate moments of wanting kind of to be told what the purpose of this is, to be told what the meaning of being here is and why we would be attached and love and then lose things. There's something that's so utterly universal about that. So, yes, like, you know, we could go to the Creation Museum and the Ark and mock many things. But underneath it, I think the more interesting question is, how is this kind of a high expression of a tendency that perhaps all of us have?
Can I ask which part of Australia you're in?
I'm in Melbourne right now.
Okay, so I'm from Sydney, but I've spent a lot of time in Queensland, and I don't know if you much, but there is quite a almost like a Bible Belt there. A lot of people who believe in, who are creationists, and there are just certain areas where you might see a plaque or something that says, oh, this area is so many million years old, and people have scratched it out and written 6,000 years, and it's just interesting to see. I mean, Ken Ham, Australian, it is just amazing that there is this kind of area in Australia where there's this heavy belief in creationism.
Yeah, I mean, and Karen, it's so interesting because, you know, it's not kind of a religious discourse is not considered a public good or a public norm in the same way as kind of religious power moves in America. Here, it's kind of not included in, you know, the public discourse or what have you, but it doesn't mean that it doesn't move just as powerfully or muscularly in an invisible way. And as you mentioned, Ken Ham is a creature of that, you know, increasingly growing constituency that's very heavily influenced by American evangelicism. And it does show up in those ways. And I think it's particularly kind of interesting and has a tragic aspect when it's in Australia, where, you know, we're home to the longest continuous human cultures on Earth. And, you know, our indigenous population is 60,000 years old. And for that not to be enough, for the, you know, we have to have a Western religious scriptural authority that's 6,000 years old. I mean, it's you know, reductive, and but it's secure and it's predictable and it's certain and it binds people together in a group. And so we can understand it. But yeah, very interesting how it presents in Australia versus America.
You won't find it as much in Melbourne or Sydney, though, that's for sure.
No.
Well, you know, we've got Ken Ham came here, I think, because the
he did.
I don't know why, maybe in particular, he came here, but he's also there was another
believers, yeah, larger population.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, maybe it's a
buy into it.
I don't want to say it's because we're more gullible, but it like it did feel a little.
I'll let you say that.
Yeah,
just joking.
But we watched. Was it? Alien Intrusion, Unmasking a Deception, a movie which featured another Australian who's doing a young Earth creationist program tied into aliens and UFOs. And I was like, what is going on? Like, I don't.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they could be coming from the Queensland area.
Yeah, maybe.
Where there's this kind of pocket of belief in creationism, but knowing that there's much more of a market for it here in the States.
Listeners can check out episode 147 from our archives if you're interested in hearing more about this particular film and how it was presented here in the U.S.
Let me just add to the peculiarity, because the 6,000-year-old Earth idea, all right, and at the same time, Aboriginals, archaeology shows have been there for at least 40,000, maybe as much as 60,000 years. So that's amazing how they can anyway, sorry, I'm being sarcastic again. Yeah. But I mean, seriously, the world's way more interesting, I think, and the literal history, the geological and the cultural history, you know, it stretches way back beyond that, and there's plenty of evidence for that right there in Australia. Maybe that's another reason to leave. I don't know, but it is peculiar.
Maybe. But Sarah, you write about several other topics as well, and I think one that would really be close to the hearts of our listeners is the story of the neurobiologist who spends his weekends ghost hunting.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that story?
Yeah, so Vlad Dubraj is a very, very lovely, very clever neurophysiologist. And he's an academic and a professor. Well, he teaches at a university, does peer-reviewed research. And at the same time, he uses his kind of free time in this ongoing, I call it a quest, to try to find empirical, you know, proof that to a scientific standard that ghosts exist. So towards that end, he, you know, is always going out to places where there have been kind of ghost sightings or other forms of paranormal activity, and he's really been trying to get, you know, to that scientific standard proof of those occurrences. So I went out with him, not expecting to be as freaked out as I actually was, and again, kind of that this isn't all there is. What we see isn't all that there is. Is death the end of things? Can we, you know, does consciousness survive us? So those issues were at play in these various, like, you know, going to work with your ghost hunter excursions. And so it was Vlad, and it was also Rob Tilley in that chapter, who is a he's a house cleaner, not like a cleaning person. He cleans.
This house is clean.
He's not going to, you won't see him with a sponge, but he's, and he's not an exorcist, but yes, more of the sage. So he, through a kind of discourse driven exchange, will clear your house of ghosts and bad spirits. He's been doing that for 30 years. And again, a very intelligent, I think kind of psychologically aware man, who utterly believes in what he's doing and has helped many people. He charges to cover his costs. And if his clients can't afford it, he won't charge them. And so I went around with Rob as well, and Rob and Vlad know each other. And kind of so I got to be embedded for a little while in that paranormal, parapsychological community to see what was kind of the world through their eyes.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose, it kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
Hey there, Monster Talkers. We'd like to introduce you to a new podcast you're going to love.
Do you like to travel? Do you like picturesque locations and getting away from it all? Well, this new podcast has all that and murder. It's called Slaycation, and it's a darkly humorous look at murders and mysterious deaths that took place on vacation.
Hosted by a true crime fanatic, her comedy writer husband, and his TV producing partner, Slaycation brings a unique perspective to chilling, thrilling, and WTF stories of vacations gone horribly wrong.
From the twisted tale of Harold and Tony Henthorne, whose romantic anniversary in the Rocky Mountains ended with one of them falling off a cliff,
to Angelica and Vincent, two recently engaged lovebirds whose Hudson Valley kayaking adventure ended underwater.
Each episode of Slaycation will have you asking, was it an accident?
Or was it murder?
But it's not just the stories that'll intrigue you. It's the discussion between a longtime married couple and business partners who happen to be Emmy-nominated TV producers.
Each episode of Slaycation also includes humor and takeaway and travel tips that will keep your next vacation from being your last.
If you're ready to pack your body bags, Slaycation is available on all major podcast platforms. Search for Slaycation on Apple Podcasts, Spotify,
or wherever you get your podcasts. Yeah.
And was that in Australia or America or both?
That one was in Australia. Three of the book stories are in America and three are in Australia. And the ghost hunters were Australian.
I mean, I started began my interest in that kind of thing in Australia. Mm. And yeah, there are a lot of believers there, a lot of interest in Australia as well as here. And I think sometimes people think that Australians are a little bit more cynical and just have a cultural tendency to not believe in these kinds of things, more secular as well. But I feel like just in terms of comparative population, it's still very big there, very popular.
Oh, I agree with that as well. And, you know, again, I don't, mostly I'm just an exhausted mom who works full time and too tired to be haunted by, you know, by the living or the dead. But it did kind of make me feel good knowing that should I have, you know, any creepiness in my own house, which not for nothing was built in 1880, that I could call Rob or I could call Vlad and that they would, you know, meet me with complete faith and, you know, I wouldn't be alone in that. And there's something beautiful in it.
That's
it would work for a lot of people. Yeah.
The theme of the book is about belief. So, and some of these, you know, you've got some paranormal things and non-paranormal things. What, how does the death doula fit within that theme?
So, when I left the Creation Museum and the Mennonites in New York, I was kind of wondering whether I could find somebody who was, who approached death in a more gentler, like a kinder, more spacious capacity that didn't necessarily view it as the enemy and could just kind of accept that, that, you know, terror, the terror or the conclusiveness or otherwise as just a fact of life. And so through kind of a very long research process, I discovered an entire profession that I had made it, you know, nearly four decades without knowing about, which was death doulas. And I knew about doulas, you know, from giving birth to two children, that they kind of assisted bringing life into the world. I didn't know that they also helped at the other end of life in helping people die. And so Annie Whitlock was not the first death doula I spoke with, but she was the one whose life was most powerfully spoke to the reason, like how one would overcome things like injustice and trauma and fear, and really be, you know, find it in themselves to be comfortable with death in an entirely new way. So what I'm saying is that life hadn't been easy for her. There was no kind of toxic positivity in how she viewed these intractable realities that we get sick and die. But she had, through her, you know, Tibetan Buddhist practice, arrived at a place that was so comfortable with death and comforting in turn. So she had an entirely different approach to it. But at the same time, she would tell you very strongly that this is not all there is. And she'd do that from a Buddhist perspective.
Yes.
So again, nothing in common with the others, and yet we see the same thing.
She you combine this idea of this service of helping people through this process with her Buddhism, and I could not stop thinking of her as the Dalai Lama.
We should have warned you about his punning.
But very, very compassionate part of the book for sure.
And kind of confronting, I think, like it took a while of speaking with Annie and visiting with her, about a year before we found one of her, well, she doesn't call them clients, they're just people that she assists.
Yeah.
But before we found one who was happy to speak with me and explain why, what she was going through and why she had called on Annie, which is, you know, fair enough, because this is end of life for the people that she deals with, and why would they want to speak to a stranger? But Katrina very much wanted to explain for others what her experience was like. And so that was a great privilege of seeing Annie helping someone, getting to know Katrina in the last 6 weeks of her life, and seeing how these beliefs could actually sustain you enough that you could meet your death with open eyes was, you know, incredibly powerful, almost holy, but very terrifying. And I don't think I've procrastinated as much in writing something as I did with kind of that research, because I found it so confronting.
Yeah.
Very fascinating.
Indeed.
And so, Sarah, this is a real labor of love, 4 years that you were working on this book and just so much research. Could you tell us a little bit about how you did your research? Clearly, a lot of it was interviews and hands-on, going to places and immersing yourself within communities.
Yeah, I mean, I always start with the people. I deliberately don't go to any of the secondary kind of more paper academic-based sources before I've had the chance to show up as an ignorant, awkward outsider and kind of see everything through those new eyes and allow myself to kind of be guided by the person themselves who's kind of sharing their worldview. So that self-selects the kind of person that's comfortable in letting me into that degree. And they have to like me and I have to like them. And it looks like hanging out for a number of years. It looks like just having a chat. And it's very circular and it's very gradual because I'm looking for change over time and I'm looking for kind of deep, thick character details. And then after that, I'll go and I'll inform myself more broadly. But like the Valentich case, the lost pilot, that was very much based on speaking to his fiance first, understanding the human aspect of the story before I went into the government files, before I went into the books, because I wanted to have that kind of fresh, those fresh eyes first off to kind of ground the story.
So I know we probably didn't warn you about this. So like we normally ask people a sort of a signature question as we're closing out our interviews. And that is, what's your favorite monster?
So, okay. So this is interesting. And I'm writing about it a little bit in the book that I'm currently working on. But I had not, you know, I've been in Australia since 1994. And I had managed not to know this, but in my interviews with the UFO researchers, and there's a couple that in the book called the Leonarders, and they founded the first support group in Australia for abductees, alien abductees. And they kind of spoke at length with me, and they're incredibly articulate, incredibly fascinating people, about the Yowie. Have you guys done anything on the Yowie? Am I
a bit here and there? Yeah.
Okay, right.
We have. So, I've always wanted to speak to Tim, the Yowie man.
There you go. You should have him on. Oh my God. So I, you know, had discovered through them, and then it became apparent the more kind of ufologists I spoke with that there was a crossover in Australian circles, at least, between those who are interested in UFOs and those who are interested in the Yowie, which is, from what I understand, very similar to the Australian Bigfoot. Although the way that it was described to me perpetually was that this Yowie or Yowies were very graceful in their enormousness. So they are adapted to the landscape. And this is Jamie Leonarder, who was explaining it to me. They could pirouette on the landscape. Their foot was adapted in ways that ours isn't to this planet. They would build these structures, either hanging from trees or, you know, teepee-like structures in the forest, and that we were incapable of seeing them because they were just so adapted to the landscape and so good at hiding. And I just thought, what a fascinating kind of pocket of reality. I don't believe in them, but it was enough that when I was out in kind of the Aussie wilderness for a different story, I was live to it. I was like, well, maybe I could see one here. Maybe if I stay here long enough, I too could see that evidence, and how I would love that. I'm just waiting to believe. So I'd have to choose the Yowie as my favorite monster.
Well, I've never thought of one as pirouetting before.
I haven't either. And I was going to say, that's so interesting. And I'm just wondering if there is an analogy there to the Indigenous people, to Aboriginal people, and how we see them as being very connected to the earth. And I've just seen that kind of link there. But fascinating.
Yeah, and kind of how hard and unnecessarily complex we have made society by, you know, driving up into our cognitive capacities to try to reason our way out of things that perhaps are best just accepted. But
I can't stop thinking about Bigfoot wearing a tutu now. I don't know. Yeah.
That was the image that I had too.
Little pink tutu.
Exactly.
Oh, I love that answer. And I think that's the first time we've ever had the Yowie as an answer in all these years.
We certainly have a spreadsheet.
It's about time. So thank you.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's a beautiful book, and we will be putting links to it in the show notes, and our listeners can find this at whatever bookstore that they like to shop at, or obviously Amazon. What are you working on now? What's next?
It started off as a commission from Harper's, but it's a story. It'll look like a trial book about a double murder that happened at the very start of COVID in the high country of Victoria. Two campers, two elderly campers went missing, and they weren't found for 18 months. And a pilot was relatively recently arrested and charged with their murder. So it's covering that trial, but it's kind of more broadly an investigation of the psychological freighting of that particular landscape. and why we find it so eerie to begin with.
If anything's more popular than true crime right now, I'm not sure what it is.
Certainly.
And plus it fits right in with your PhD in criminal law, right?
So, it goes back to your roots. Yeah.
Well, it is. I mean, all of it's kind of about the story, right? It's about character and causation and the context. And so the law is always concerned with that form of storytelling. And I think kind of we all are. It's not really the statistically rare acts of violence. I think we're more attracted to the elements of normality in these stories, the way, you know, it starts off where they could be anyone and look where it went. But I just want to say the High Country is very interesting for in terms of monsters, because this is where we've had regular sightings of the Tassie tiger, possibly by true believers, and the Black Panther, which has never been conclusively documented. And Yowie sightings as well, and UFO sightings as well. So it's kind of live with all of these things. And, you know, I've never seen it in my trips out there, but doesn't mean that I won't encounter them in the future. So maybe, you know, I could come back if I see one.
Keep your eyes peeled.
Well, you've got a real knack for putting words together in beautiful ways. So I look forward to seeing what you do.
Thanks, Beth. I'm really grateful to you. Thank you for having me, and thank you for having the show. This is super interesting.
You are very welcome. Thanks for coming, joining us.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
Bye, guys.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard an interview with author Sarah Krasnostein discussing her book, The Believer. A link to her book is in the show notes, but you can also find it at your favorite bookstore or order it online. We really enjoyed Sarah's book and suspect that you will too. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. We hope you enjoyed this episode and will join us next week for something new.
Been a Monster House presentation.